Hey, everybody. It's All You Ever Think About is Sparks. This is your host, Christian Huey. I'm joined today by Monty Mallon and also by Paul Barrett. Paul Barrett, if you're not familiar, and you should be, is the author of the Sparks blog, One for the Ages. And he has a lot of really, really interesting theories, mainly about the lyrical content of their songs throughout the decades, and can't wait to get into that with him. We're going to start off, though, picking up where we left off on the last episode, right here with Monty. We were discussing the second half of the Womp That Sucker album. There was something that Monty didn't get a chance to elucidate on that he wanted to now. I'm going to give him that chance now.
Okay, well, thank you. And Paul, it's great to have you with us. And so I basically, when we were going through the different songs, we went through That's Not Nastasia, and I conveyed a lot of enthusiasm for it, but I don't feel like I really captured why I think it's such a special and great song. And as I listened to it and tried to get my notes down, I thought, if you didn't mind, I really appreciate you indulging me. I would just like to go through it a little bit and kind of really go into a little bit of detail about why this is a song. I call this Chaos, Discord, and Cacophony, The Genius of Ron Mayall in 4 Minutes and 57 Seconds. And this is about a true descent into madness, in my opinion. So if you don't mind, should I just get started?
Please. Christian?
Okay. And both of you feel free to commentate to your heart's content and tell me where you disagree or whatever. But basically, if you listen to the song, it's about unmet expectations. And here I want to make a point about Russell's vocals. And we talked about this a little bit, Christian. Mm-hmm. But yeah, on the surface, yes, he is concerned that he can't identify Nastasia. But if you listen to his vocals, he gets more and more frenetic and more worried. And most important, the voice he uses, the tone and the way he conveys things is like any other that I think he has used in any other Sparks song, period. There's nowhere else where he sings like this. Mm-hmm. So let me break down the song a little bit. And I also want to focus on David Kendrick and his amazing contributions to this song. Hmm. So it starts with this almost military style snare drum opening, right? Da 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 da. Then right into some weird distorted keyboard from Ron. And going to this theme of expectations, which are being completely tumbled up here, what you're hearing is that even before Russell starts singing, they're messing with our expectations. So after the drum opening in 4-4, they immediately go into four measures of 3-4 time. So in my opinion, that 3-4 time is clearly setting up a return to 3-4 time later in the song, or is it? And I'll come back to that.
Okay.
But then they hit you with Russell in that tone of voice that I just described. It's frenetic and worried, but compare it to something like Where's My Girl on the same album, which is much more traditional than what you hear here, right? Mm-hmm. And the song proceeds for a little while in a traditional 4-4 cadence, but notice that David Kendrick is already playing with expectations here. His beat is a little stronger on 4 than it is on 2, where traditionally you'd hear a strong downbeat on the 2 and the 4. He's going instead of like that. So already they're starting to mess with you a little bit. And you don't, if you're just a casual listener, you might not catch this, but if you really think about this and listen to it, this is what I hear at least. And so then they start to throw all these things into the song. After the first few measures, they start to introduce a chorus. If you listen hard enough, you'll hear it. Just more fun for the dollar. And then you have Ron's keyboard playing, which starts out at this point very minimalist, usually a single note played at the end of a measure. It just adds a little accent, but he doesn't let the keyboard dominate the song. So you hear, that's not Nastasia. Bing. That's not Nastasia. Bing. And that's all he does. Mm-hmm. But he just keeps that up at the beginning, but later he ends up dominating the song. But speaking of Ron, who writes these songs, this is probably a good opportunity to point out how hilarious these vocals are. And this gets back to something that we've talked about a lot, Christian, which is this is just a fun album. And so you have these, presidential wives and topless maids, more or less identically the same. I think that's really funny. Mm-hmm. But on a deeper level, I mean, the whole song is like that. But on the deeper level, it just shows the confusion that's building up in Russell's mind, right? He's getting more and more confused. He doesn't know what's what. And then around 2 minutes and 7 seconds into the song, you get a big change. And here's where things get interesting. So just bear with me. First, the song breaks into a steady bass drum beat. That's not Nastasia. Boom, 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 boom. Then the keyboard comes back for four measures of 3/4 time. Then Russell comes back in and the music reverts back to 4/4 time. But here's where it's, I want you to think about this. Then the keyboard comes back for two measures in 3/4 time, but notice that there's an extra beat there. So it's either 4/4 time and then one extra beat, and then it goes into two measures of 3/4 time, or a new measure of 4/4 time begins, but the keyboards come in for three beats and then it's followed by one measure of 3/4 time. And unless you're really listening, you're not going to catch this. But the point is, it's not what you expect when you listen to what's supposedly a, you know, a pop song, right?
And so, it's a song about playing with expectations.
Yeah, exactly. It's not linear. And in either case, there's an extra beat between the 4/4 time.
Even lyrically.
Reversion to the 3/4 time. So what does that tell us? One, what you just said, totally playing with our expectations, even if it's subconsciously. Two, there's a good chance that the casual listener won't even notice it. And three, fascinatingly, Kendrick just plays a beat as if there's no break in the 4/4 time structure, even while the rest of the sections are all over the place. I've never heard that before in any other song. And to me, that is the absolute definition of genius. So bear with me just for another minute or two.
Please.
Okay. The section ends with four measures in 3/4 time and then reverts back to the 4/4 time for the remainder of the song. But at 3:23, this is where it starts a whole new phase of devolution. Just as the narrator is dissolving into chaos and confusion, so does the song. Russell is dealing with the fact that all of these women around him are not Nastasia. That's not Nastasia. That's Nastasia. That's not Nastasia. That's not Nastasia. There's a taunting nah in the background now just to add to the mix, because why not? The keyboards are now taking over, even though they were once dormant. Now they're taking over. The whole band gradually drowns out Russell. So think of it from Russell's perspective. The song is just taking over. It represents the world, just drowning him out. You can literally see the song kind of dissolving down the drain, but then you should also be listening, in my opinion, to David Kendrick here. His drums are acting as a counterpoint to the melody, not the traditional role of the drums. He's almost improvising along, adding to the cacophony as the song winds down. Drums and bass are playing in 4/4 time. Keyboards are playing in 3/4 time. It's all over the place. And Ron is just playing these crazy discordant notes all over the keyboard. Bah, 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 bah. So what does this tell us? It tells me that the inability to recognize Nastasia has driven our protagonist completely mad. There are multiple voices probably in his head, right? And if you listen to the song, you'll hear all these different voices. And they're saying, that's not Nastasia. They're saying all these different things, right? Mm-hmm. They're mocking and confusing. No longer does anyone know who Nastasia really is. And that creates the perfect segue to Wacky Women, which comes without a break between the songs, The End.
Oh.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. Well, I really love that.
How long have you been cooking that? Listeners. Oh, well done. Well done. That was great. There's a lot of things that. And again, this is why I love having Monty on the show, because I'm not a drummer, and so hearing from a drummer's perspective really makes me appreciate it, especially when it relates to anything about David Kendrick.
Well, that's Paul, really cool. I was on a plane ride, that. And so I had plenty of time, and this is how I used my time.
That was awesome.
Probably not the
Well, it's funny because I was listening to this song a few months ago when we were communicating initially, and I was actually going to reach out to ask about some of the technicalities on the drumming in this song, mm-hmm. because what I find really interesting about it is for the first half of the song, you do have these strange times, or you have a mix of time signatures.
Mm-hmm.
And the moment that he recognizes Nastasia, as soon as he sees her, that's the point when it's 4-4. So for me, the way I've seen it is, I completely agree that the drums are integral to the meaning of the song. But I think the lyrics might be commenting on the music itself, on finding some kind of way forward for the band. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, and I might be completely wrong about this. Those first few beats, when it's for dum, 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 that's classic disco for a moment. Is that correct? No, not at the start. Not at the start.
What's your theory? This isn't a right or wrong. This is your theory. So keep going.
So when it gets to the point where he first says, that's Nastasia, at that point, it becomes about repetition. Like the first half of the song, every time it gets to a point where it feels like it's going to resolve, it shifts into a new style. Not a new style, but like a new phase of the song. So, when he sees Nastasia, that's the point where, even though you have crazy time signatures all sitting on top of each other, you have that dum, dum, dum right the way through it. So I saw it as commenting on the music itself, as if the band are looking to find whatever Nastasia is musically. It's not a particularly well thought through theory, I'll give you that much, but the Descent into Madness narrative, I love that. I think it's beautiful. I really like the way you've broken it down with the different musical elements, because I just can't parse that at all. Just knowing that there are just the fact that the style of the song changes when Nastasia first appears, I find really interesting. And then as the elements from earlier on in the song come in, it you get the it's both Nastasia and not Nastasia at the same time.
And Schrodinger's Nastasia.
Say that again.
Schrodinger's Nastasia.
Yeah, it's
collapsed waveform. Yeah.
See, I don't know if he ever actually finds Nastasia. I don't know about that. But Christian, why don't you? Maybe we should get on track and let Paul talk about his big theory.
Well, absolutely.
Here.
Okay, so you were going to say something right there. I saw it, Paul.
Yeah. I was just going to say the reason I mentioned the disco beat is because I think on a few songs on the album, now it's not an album that I've got big grand theories about, other than in a couple of places. My theory about the album is that it's it kind of reflects their move from disco to rock, is referenced in a few places. Well, it can be interpreted that way. I'd understand that a lot of people would scoff at this, but if you go back to earlier in the album, you've got Funny Face. And Funny Face, it sounds really straightforward. You know, it's a beautiful man. It's a male model who isn't taken seriously and, you know, yearns to have a funny face. But I see that as representing where they've been as a band and what they really want. So they start off like on the cover of a Vogue magazine, you know, looking perfect. And all they want is to have a funny face. And if you think of how the band reinvented themselves, then it's like, it's kind of like making themselves look worse in many ways, because they were this perfect, pristine band, and their desire was to turn into a funny band. And this whole album is hilarious. It's the whole thing is, you know, it's full of jokes, it's full of humor. And I think that be seen in lots of places in the album. I think on I Married a Martian, it's a similar thing where he meets this beautiful Martian lady who turns into something hideous and goes and effectively takes over the world. And that can reflect, you know, Sparks getting in early on sort of bring in a songwriter's view to disco music. So I don't know how off the wall that theory sounds, but, you know, there are lines like she has a European flair. And if you think that, you know, they were working with Giorgio Moroder and doing this sort of German-Italian style disco music. I think it was like a conscious decision to move away from the pristine sounds of disco music to fun rock music. And I think that, well, while it sounds like I might be plucking things out at random, if you follow song by song from Number One in Heaven, the Noel album, When I'm With You, Terminal Drive. Like song by song, you can see lots of comments on every song leading to this idea.
Well, why don't we step back for a second and give you a chance to kind of lay out your...
I was going to say that too.
I'm sorry, yeah. But just lay out the bigger meta theory that you have, and then we can relate it to certain albums or songs, however you want to do it. But let's give you a chance to kind of lay out your thinking on this.
Do you mind if I step back even just a little bit further and just ask you, Paul, just sort of your own, as I ask, you know, everyone who's a Sparks fan, what your Sparks origin story may be when you came to understand them and follow them and so on?
Yeah, of course. So when I was a child, my dad had a cassette that he'd play in the car, and it was the Best of Island Records. So I feel like I've always known this town ain't big enough for the both of us. And I think that's probably true of a lot of British people. It just feels like it's always been there. Then when I was 15 or 16, it was 1994, and I saw a repeat of that classic Top of the Pops performance with Ron scowling at the camera. And it was the first time I'd heard it with adult ears, and I just thought it was amazing. It really spoke to me. And there was a little comment at the bottom of the screen saying, you know, this band is still going. And I found that amazing because, you know, they were so old is how I saw it.
Yeah.
And then a few days later, I was off from school, and there was a TV show called Pebble Mill, and they came on and they did Where Do I Get to Sing My Way? And I was just captivated by it. I thought it was absolutely brilliant. I loved the Ronald on the keyboard instead of a Roland. And I think with that song, because at the time they were positioning themselves as... Or rather, they were being sold, I suppose, as the band who were the forerunners of Pet Shop Boys and Erasure. Mm-hmm. And these were bands who were huge at the time. The idea of them coming back and sort of taking their rightful title as, you know, the people who originated this, I thought that tied in really well with the chorus of When Do I Get to Sing My Way? This idea of deserving recognition, deserving being, treated as one of the greats. So right from the start for me, I've seen Sparks as being quite self-referential, quite meta. And then they fell off the map for me because I didn't pick up on the couple of albums that followed. I think I heard one of the songs off Balls, but it didn't really get me. But then...
You did a whole very interesting blog about Balls later on.
My opinion of that album has changed completely. Yeah. I think it's a work of genius now, but I don't think Sparks have done anything that's less than genius. I think they're absolutely brilliant.
So that's an interesting, I'm sorry to interrupt real quickly. That's an interesting re-entry point to them with a song, with a single that is so clearly autobiographical in its spirit. But from that, you were able to you took that and superimposed that over much of their career over decades. Yeah. And how did that come about?
It came about shortly after A Steady Drip, 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 because. Okay. I'm not a person who really puts myself out there on the internet much. I don't have any aspirations to write about music or, if you'd have told me a few years ago that I'd be a guest on a podcast, it's just not who I am. But I've always been interested in these sort of in-jokes in Sparks music. So a good example would be The Rhythm Thief, where they've moved away from dance music and the lyrics represent that. You know, they're saying goodbye to the beat just as they've changed their style. So every time a new Sparks album would come out, I'd look for these subtle jokes that you might not get the first time or the second time or the third time, but when it clicks, it's hilarious. Now, I sort of signed up to a few Facebook groups hoping to have a conversation about what I saw as, funny little in-jokes. Mm-hmm. And I was surprised that other people saw it in a different way. So an example is Left Out in the Cold that I saw about being out of the spotlight, letting other people take the glory while they're happy doing the difficult work in the background. I'm not sure how many people would agree with that interpretation, but when it got to trying to justify it in these conversations with people who didn't see it the same way, the more I'd write about these things, the more other songs would tie in. So that's where it's all been about for me. It's been every time I write about a song, I'll get ideas about three other songs. And it's kind of spiraled out from there.
So, but I can understand that. And as I understand your theory, and here's where I need you to tell me if I'm completely misunderstanding it, is that there, part of it is that on a song by song or even album by album basis, there's a lot of self-reference. There's a lot of self-referential material about their career. There's in jokes about it. It's kind of a commentary on where they are at that particular time.
Yeah.
But it always seems to me that what you were saying is that there's a second level, which is
a higher level,
all kind of connected almost to the point. And here you can tell me if I'm wrong, but almost to the point where it's been planned out to some extent.
So planned out is the wrong way of putting it.
Address that idea of this second level, that would be, and then the other points, that would be great.
So I think that they do call forward in their music quite a lot. So, how can I put it? I don't think it's necessarily planned out, but I think there's an element of storytelling to their career as well as to the individual songs. So in terms of pointing forward, one example that I've got is gratuitous sax and senseless violins. Actually, this is, it might take a while to explain it. So,
no, go for it.
If you bear with me. So, the album is bookended by two short skits, effectively. They're not full songs. So, the first one is gratuitous sax. And it says, you need another element. You need it right away. What could I do? What could I do? An element to titillate so they won't go away. I thought of you and how you blew till you were blue. And then there's a short snippet of saxophone. Now, the thing that makes sense to me there is that this is a reference to Charlie Parker, because obviously he's a big presence on the album already with When I Kiss You, I Hear Charlie Parker Playing. So he suffered from chronic depression. So I Thought of You and How You Blew Till You Were Blue means, you know, it's quite easy to tie those two songs together. Now, I read up on Charlie Parker, and one of his aspirations was to create a new genre of music. So he wanted to fuse classical music with jazz, and he never quite achieved it. He worked with string quartets, I believe, but he never achieved this goal. So if you then go to the end of the album, it's got the song Senseless Violins, and it's a spoken word by Ron, and he says instead of the usual drums and bass, he heard senseless violins. And that, to me, sounds like a template to what was to follow, but years later than their next album. This came out in 94. Then in 2002, was it, that Little Beethoven came out? But yeah, Little Beethoven follows that template of, you know, it loses the drums and bass, and instead it's got these crazy violins. Now, as we know, the album that followed was Plagiarism. And Plagiarism was something that they were quite vocal about being unhappy about. They were coerced into making that album by the record label. So also, the first song on Plagiarism is Pulling Rabbits Out of a Hat, which starts with strings and stacked vocals, and it is reminiscent of what they were going to do later with Little Beethoven. To a degree, it goes off in a different direction, but there's this continuity there. So if you go back to the start again with Gratuitous Sax, and it says you need another element, you need it right away, what could I do? Well, if you think of the position of the band at the time, they'd been off the map for 5 years because they'd been making this failed movie project with Tim Burton. Before that, their career was at an all-time low. So if you consider that in order to keep the band going, it was vital for them to gain an audience. Therefore, that whole album can be seen as a way to get back into the limelight in order to resuscitate their career enough to be able to do their more distant goal of producing Little Beethoven. So it could be that in 1994, they already had the idea for what they ultimately released in 2002 with their shift in genre. There's more evidence on the album of it. If you think that When Do I Get to Sing My Way, it's about an outsider wanting fame. It's about an outsider wanting in. Mm-hmm. The same thing applies to I Thought I Told You to Wait in the Car on the periphery of fame. You've got The Ghost of Liberace about somebody who's washed up, but by the end of the song, the audience are applauding. Before the album came out, you had National Crime Awareness Week, which is part of the same package, effectively. And in that song, it's about a criminal who enjoys the little bit of fame that he gets when he's when he appears on television during National Crime Awareness Week. So these songs do tie together in like this strangely specific way.
Yeah.
And that's something that you see, you know, in these four songs. Is it four songs? You see it in a few places on Gratuitous Sax and Senseless Violins. And I can't think of any other songs from their career about being outsiders wanting fame. But at that point where they needed it the most, at the point where they needed it to revive their career, mm-hmm. that's what they sang about.
Well, I'm going to ask you this. How yeah. soon in their career did you see this? Do you see this start to happen where they were commenting on their career and commenting on the trajectory of the career, where they had come and where they planned to go? Do you see this happening earlier?
I see it. The first time I can see it as a thread is Number One in Heaven. Starting with Tryouts for the Human Race. Mm-hmm. There's a thread that goes right the way through that up until about halfway through Womp That Sucker, where I've kind of lost the thread a bit there, which is why when I was asked to comment on That's Not Nostalgia.
It's a hard one, that one.
It is a difficult one. But from 1993 to the current day, every song can be tied into this, as crazy as that might sound to many people. I'm sure there'll be a lot of cynicism, and I understand why. I know what I'd think if somebody told me this a few years ago. But it's absolutely true.
I guess when I'm listening to it, to hear you explain it, it all sounds so logical. It's like, yeah, I guess he's right. But let me just add something to it and hear what you think. As I think about it and listen to you, it seems to me that beginning with, I agree with you that this area of really focusing on their career as part of their music probably began, I would put it a little bit later. I would put it after that Dead period. And then they came out with Gratuitous Sax and let's just accept everything that you said. It seems to me that if you looked at Gratuitous Sax, and then I love your little point about plagiarism that you threw in, but then moving on from that and going to Balls and then going to Little Beethoven, perhaps in that period, they weren't quite sure where they were going. They knew they wanted to go somewhere, and it kind of ended, the journey ended with Little Beethoven, which in my mind established Sparks Point Two. That's where they really became, in my mind, the entity known as Sparks. They were had a very identifiable sound that carries through to one degree or another to this very day.
Yeah.
So I guess that would mean that in that interpretation, that would be that period from Gratuitous Sax, maybe a little earlier, to Little Beethoven's kind of a transitional period where they were figuring out where they needed to go, how they wanted to make their music different. And then Little Beethoven was kind of introducing the new Sparks, where they had complete control of their career. They had their own recording studio. They did everything on their own with synthesizers. It was just a very different kind of Sparks that's probably as good as what we had in the 70s. But does that sound like it has any resonance to you, or do you think there was
more? It absolutely resonates with me. You know, there's a clear change in the band from 2002 from Little Beethoven. But this is quite a wild theory, but for Balls, I believe that it was done in a way where they didn't want to, how can I put this? I think it was, to a degree, an intentional act of self-sabotage.
Do you?
Yeah, I do. I do. I think they did the same thing with Terminal Jive, in my opinion, and Annette, but it takes a lot of explaining. So can I explain it in terms of Terminal Jive?
Go for it. We recently talked about that on the show. So, yeah.
So Terminal Jive starts with When I'm With You. And my opinion on most of these songs is that they can be tied to the creative process or aspirations or performance. So When I'm With You, it sounds like it's a song about relationships. It sounds like it's a twist on a love song. But I don't think that's necessarily the case. Or rather, it's not only the case, because these songs have millions of interpretations.
Sure.
But I think there's always this kernel of writing about their own creative processes. So with When I'm With You, you have verses that are intentionally clunky. You've got, you know, I almost feel normal when I'm with you. I'm really well adjusted when I'm with you. Then when you get to the chorus, it says it's the break in a song when I should say something special, but the pressure is on and I can't think up nothing special. So that seems like it's about songwriting.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I actually know that that is. Because because it was not Marauder. It was
Faltermeyer.
Faltermeyer, who was encouraging Ron to come up with a middle eight that would work in that, and he felt pressured, and then that came out in his lyrics.
Oh, okay.
As far as I understand that,
I didn't know that story, but So. Effectively, it can be treated as a song about having nothing to say.
Right. Which I love. And I agree.
I think it's it brings an extra dimension to the song to say, you know, when I'm with you, I can't write an interesting song.
Yeah.
Despite it being a really brilliant song and obviously really creative. What sells the idea for me is... less than 10 minutes later on the album, you have an instrumental version of the same song.
Right.
So you have a song about nothing to say.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
But then the songs between it also tie into that narrative. Because the way I see it is the whole album is about wanting to move away from disco music. Right? It's about having nothing to say with disco music. So if you consider rock and roll people in a disco world,
sure,
that's criticizing what rock and roll people do. You know, they make LP records, they make comebacks, you know, things that...
Monty's making some faces over here. And I think I might know one reason why. The songs that the songs that that Ron and Russell had written that were originally to be part of that album were just just thrown out, right? They didn't want to have it. Harold Faltermeyer didn't want to have anything to do with them and had them write some new songs. So I wonder how much the brand new songs, the brand new lyrics that were, you know, I guess tossed together in just a couple of weeks had to do with what they originally planned on doing and what their original thoughts were.
So this is where it gets controversial, because I think they're not telling the whole truth with that.
Oh boy.
Okay. So if you think of the end of the Sparks Brothers movie, they make a big feature of the idea that they don't tell the full truth. They give lots of false facts about Sparks. In the early days, I think they said that Doris Day was their mother, but they were catalog models. And obviously, bands play with the press. You know, this isn't something new, but they didn't tell us much about themselves on that documentary. But one of the things they made perfectly clear is that you can't trust everything you hear. So, I think it would be a grand. It would be a huge artistic statement to make an album intentionally to not to sound commercial, but to not want to sell lots of records. And they didn't promote it outside of France, where it was one of the biggest singles of their career. They could have just popped onto a cross-channel ferry to where they already had an audience in the UK, but they didn't promote it. Given their career choices over the years, they're not a band who yearn for fame, despite having songs about yearning for fame, weirdly, or yearning for glory. But they never, ever make the easy decision. So how amazing would it be if Terminal Jive was a concept album about not having anything to say, so not wanting any success with it? And every song on the album, if you go on the blog, I can tie into this theory.
I think
they did the same with Bulls. I think they did the same with Annette. They were both designed to fail is probably putting it a bit harshly, because creatively it's flourishing. You know, I'm not doing down any of these works. I think they're absolute works of genius, but I think to an extent they're writing their own story. They're writing their own career.
Well, I would put Annette aside for the moment. That would be a whole nother discussion. That's something they worked on for years, and my impression is that they really did believe strongly in it. I'd be interested to hear you say, let's leave that aside for a second. And just what about a more traditional interpretation of Terminal Jive, which is that it's just something they were forced into, their original songs were rejected, and they just wanted to get it over with. And they didn't know where their career was. And they were in their early 20s at this time. They were early 20s,
30s.
What? 30s?
Yes.
Well, all right. They're young. And they were very, from my perspective, they were very young. Yeah. And they just wanted to get it over with. And so they threw out lyrics. Here's where I think there's convergence, that they threw out lyrics that were kind of just so insipid, you know, baby, baby, give it to me, give it to me. And it was like, it was designed to fail. Maybe it was just that they had given up and they wanted to move on and stop working with this marauder guy and just do what they wanted to do, because they've always wanted to move on in their career after a few albums to something new. And they just let it go. And so they didn't bother touring it, just because they wanted to move on, get back to LA, figure out what they were going to do next. Mm-hmm. And that's how we got to Womp.
I understand that. And I can see how, that's the truth of the Sparks story. All I'm saying is, if you look at the lyrics to these songs, it's using simple language to write about songs with simple language. You know, When I'm With You sounds like it's intentionally basic.
I agree with you. I think that was definitely written with full intention of that.
Yeah.
And so that I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I know that was the only song that was not thrown out by Faltermeyer and his ilk when they went into the recording studio. So
I think following up a song that is about having nothing to say,
right,
with a song that opens with "Baby, baby, give it to me, give it to me." You know, but this is from the same writer who a few years before wrote, "You are a khaki coloured bombardier. It's Hiroshima that you're nearing." Right. You know, these aren't the same. We know the caliber
sure.
of Ron Mayall's lyrics. Sure. So if he's working to a concept, if you take the song Young Girls, mm-hmm. now obviously it's a hugely controversial and alienating song, and it's talking about using small little words.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to me, that's setting up a communication with it's about songwriting, but to a new audience.
You want us to use small little words to write our songs.
Yeah, because I think we're the transitioning.
Satisfy the...
Well, we've heard that Marauder thought Ron's lyrics were just too out there. I mean, that mm-hmm. comes. We talked about that, and it comes across in somewhere or other, in the books or somewhere. Marauder said, you got to dial it down, guys.
Well, if you give me the benefit of the doubt for this conversation, my feeling is that throughout the time they were working with Marauder, they were doing down their own input. Now, we all know that the Mayall brothers are creative powerhouses, yet they basically said, oh, Number One in Heaven was, you know, the main riff of it was written by Giorgio Moroder. On Terminal Jive, they said that they said they weren't allowed to play keyboards on their own record, you know, and I think it's part of the concept. But I think it's something to be revealed. So this is mm-hmm. what I'm getting at with it. I think we've seen the documentary. We've heard their side. Well, sorry, we've heard other people's view of their career, but they've never really broken it down. And I think at some point we're going to hear why they made so many crazy decisions. Why when disco music was the biggest form of music in the world and they were ahead of the game with it, they decided to just tour California. Well, and
to answer that question, I would say it was because they couldn't tour with that.
Well, that's something that that's something that I don't really buy as well, because if Kraftwerk had been playing live for years before, it wasn't impossible. To go out and perform this way. If you look in the 80s, all of the synth pop duos played live. Some of them had reel to reel tapes on stage with
The technology changed within just a couple of years. I mean, by 1981, there would have been no issue with, you know, Sparks playing all of Number One in Heaven live. It wouldn't have been a problem with the synth they had at the time. So, you know, I hear you. I guess there was a question I was wanting to get to. Have you ever developed a theory about a Sparks album or a song, but maybe you changed your mind later on in the wake of newer material that came out?
I've changed my mind on. I've added to. The concepts I've been writing about. I'm trying to think of examples, but it feels like it's always in draft form. On my blog, I've written, I think it's about 10 posts now, and they're quite hefty, you know. And in it, I think I've gone into like quite excruciating detail. I've tried to simplify it as much as possible, but you know, I'm not a writer. I'm just trying to get these ideas out of my head and onto the page. So right now I feel like I've covered about 50%, maybe less of these ideas. So some things I've gone over quite quickly. But, you know, there are songs where, there are so many different angles to come at on them.
Well, what you're saying is so interesting because it's kind of hinting that they really started this period of self-reflection as early as the number one in heaven days, whereas I tended to see it a little bit later, really after the psychic girl stuff all kind of fell through and they were wondering where to go. So I just wonder, where do the '80s fit in to your theory? Was this a period where they really were just trying to make it and have some fun? Or was this also part of some meta plan that they had in place?
The '80s is a bit of a struggle for me because originally I thought all of this started with Bulls in 2000. For the '80s, I'd lost for Fred on One Bat Sucker like halfway through. So what I'm hoping. If we take Terminal Jive as an example, I had no opinions on Terminal Jive in terms of, you know, meta theories until I listened to you guys talk about it on the podcast. So what happened for me is I've got some quite good ideas in my view about Number One in Heaven that answered a lot of the questions that you guys posed on the podcast, in my view. You know, that was followed by the Noel album. Is it Dancing is Dangerous or is it Is There More to Life Than Dancing?
Is There More to Life Than Dancing?
Is There More to Life? Thank you.
Yep. Yeah, well, that album justified a lot of what I'd written about Number One in Heaven. And then that follows on directly into Terminal Jive. So, yeah, the '80s. I don't know as much about their career decisions in the '80s, I suppose, or how they presented themselves as a band. So I'm hoping that as you guys do more podcasts, hopefully I'll get some eureka moments. But in terms of the '90s and beyond, you know, if you were to pick any song, I could tell you how it fits in.
Why do you think they're interested in doing that? Why don't they want to just write songs like Popularity, which is just a fun little tune about, or Cool Places, which is about going out and having fun?
It's interesting you say that, though. Popularity and Cool Places. These are two songs with really similar sensibilities. And if you look at the other songs on the albums, I haven't got the track list into hand. But is it Praying for a Party? Is that on that album?
Yeah, it's in there.
So you've got this one album where they're focusing on coolness and popularity.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't come on other albums. So to me, it's not. It's packaged, you know? Mm-hmm. It's not that they're just writing the next thing that comes in their mind. They're writing things that fit into some template of what Sparks are at that moment in time.
Sure.
But I'm asking something a little different, and I'm not asking to challenge you per se.
Yeah.
Well, I guess just to get your perspective on it, because
I
picked those songs out of my head, but what about Praying for a Party, music that you can dance to, whatever it is, aren't there times when they just wanted to write a song that they thought people might like?
I think they always want to write songs that people quite like. But what I think is that they're constantly evolving what Sparks is as a band, like the purpose of Sparks. And I think there's always a kernel, like the starting point for any song, which is self-referential or pushing them somewhere new. So, you know, the song that grows out of that might be, you know, almost completely random, but you can always get this seed. The examples you've used are difficult because it's the '80s again, and that's the weakest area in this theory. But it's interesting to use music that you can dance to, because that in itself, as we saw on the documentary, is definitely self-referential, because they were asked by their record label to, you know, can't you just write music that you can dance to? And So that is a song that's is you know, putting the finger up to the record label.
They seem to like to do that, don't they?
Yeah.
Can I make a point? I know I've been talking quite a lot, not giving you guys space, but
no, this is, we want to hear from you.
So when we were talking a few months ago, I made the point that the end of the net would tie into whatever comes next.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that I was confident about that is all of the net I can tie into like quite a neat little theory. But so the song's recently come out, The Girl is Crying in a Latte.
Mm-hmm.
Now, obviously, the end of a net and the girl is crying in a latte, a bit, you know, completely different stories, completely unrelated. But not to spoil the end of the film for anybody who hasn't seen it, but it involves a really sad girl leaving. And then the girl is crying in a latte. The lyrics, oh, I can't remember off the top of my head, but they watch a girl sipping coffee, trying to figure out why she's crying, and then she leaves and is replaced by another one. So the last scene of Annette and this song both have sad girls leaving. While that might sound
to be replaced tenuous, by another sad girl.
Exactly, yeah. Uh-huh. So while that sounds like a really tenuous link, it's definitely there, and it's something that I predicted a few months ago. Also,
nice.
If you look at the track listing for the new album, you've got the Mona Lisa's leaving tonight, or the Mona Lisa packing, leaving late tonight, I think it's called. There's another one about leaving. So on all of these albums, you get recurring themes. And it looks like leaving is a recurring theme on this next album.
Well, Ryan has been talking about that since Slow Boat.
Oh, my. That goes way back.
Is that about a sad girl leaving?
Oh, it's about a girl leaving.
Oh, my gosh.
I don't know how sad she is. Maybe she's happy.
Well, if she's around now.
Yeah. Sadness is a core part of the end of Annette, though, to be fair.
For sure. And you had a lot of great stuff. I did take some time to read a lot of what you wrote about Annette, and I do want to get into that. And I think kind of that Monty kind of hinted that, you know, we might have more time for that on another episode, because there was so much there, and I really appreciate that. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about for this episode, Monty? I'm going to give it to Monty first.
At this point, I'm really interested to hear what your theory is about Annette, but.
It's a whole thing. We should.
It's
really
a whole
think,
thing.
Yeah.
But what I'm interested in is how would, if we kind of converge on this idea that, all right, let me step back. I think I see that some of these points are songs are self-referential, and that there's kind of a thread to a lot of it. I tend to think that, you know, maybe in some cases they just want to have some fun. It's not 100% of a complete approach, but I hear what you're saying, and I think it's great. But I think where we tend to agree is that, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that it was really with Little Beethoven where they said, this is Sparks 2.0.
I can get on board with that.
This is who, okay, so we agree. How would you define and how would you characterize the new Sparks, and why did that set a template that they kept to for a long time? And what is it that's different about Sparks now? Let me just say one other quick point, because my feeling is that a lot of what they've gone through their career is just figuring out where they want to go and what they want to do. And then they finally, after all the different things that happened, they finally found their voice with Little Beethoven. But yeah, you see it a little bit differently. So I'm just wondering how that album in particular impacts your overall thinking and how you would define the Sparks that we have now. And then I have a whole nother set of questions about where they're going. But let's talk about that.
You're prepared.
So Little Beethoven is absolutely Sparks 2.0. I see their career as being in two distinct parts. The first half of their career is it's almost about chasing different music scenes, because like when they came to England, it was to become an English band. Mm-hmm. When they went to when they recorded Number One in Heaven, they claimed that it was recorded in Germany, despite being recorded in America. So it, in it LA, was. Let me interrupt
real quickly. When they left England and went to New York to record Big Beat, it was to become an American band.
Exactly. So it was almost like they were always chasing the next version of the band. Now, with Little Beethoven, I believe it was a reinvention, but it wasn't like they've said that they recorded a whole album's worth of material in the style of Bulls, its predecessor, and threw it away, and sort of came up with Little Beethoven almost on the spur of the moment. And that's something that I don't really believe. I think they're being I think there's a bit of storytelling there. So there are things like The Calm Before the Storm, and a lot of Bulls is calling forward to Little Beethoven. So I think they knew that was coming. Now, in terms of how they stopped reinventing themselves, I'm actually writing about Hello Young Lovers at the moment. Okay. And so this is the first album that wasn't kind of almost throwing away the previous version of the band. It wasn't reinventing. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the amazing things, in my view, about Hello Young Lovers is you have repetition in the lyrics, mm-hmm. but you also have repetition in the stories they tell. So right at the start, you have All I Do Now Is Dick Around. So, every day. It ends with the organist of the Notre Dame Cathedral doing mm-hmm. the same thing every day. And if you look at the album in its entirety, there's only one song that doesn't feature somebody doing the same thing.
Morrissey?
So no, on Hello Young Lovers, that's on exactly.
Oh, sorry, that's not the right album. Yeah. Sorry.
It's actually waterproof, but it's the exception that proves the rule. There's a reason for it, which you know you'll see when I when I post that blog. But yeah, every song feature. If you think about if there's no such thing as aliens, it's look out the window every day. If you look at Here Kitty. It's a fireman who rescues cats from various different types of trees. And then that concept is repeated in the circus where he wins like sexual favors for rescuing cats. It's there on every song. Yeah, a remake whose action is louder than words. So the idea of repetition is all over that album. And this is the first time that they're repeating the concept of the band. So instead of reinventing themselves, they're effectively doing what they did on Little Beethoven, and that's reflected in the songwriting, and it's because it's building up to something bigger. Another example of this, if you don't mind me just ranting on. So if you take Rock, 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 the production on it, the songwriting is completely different, but the production is exactly the same template as the Rhythm Thief, right down to there's like this gated vocal sound. It's got the it's got the timpani drums, it's got the strings, and it's saying, you know, soft passages will get you into trouble. It's saying a quiet period in the band's story could get them into trouble. It shows a lack of decisiveness, a lack of feeling, a lack of fervor, because people might think they're at a low point in their career, but in the future, they promise that they'll rock. So what I think is on Little Beethoven and the albums that followed, they were aware that they had this 20-year career ahead of them. They'd set a distant sight. And it takes some justification, but I could go through it song by song, but I'm not sure if that's what you guys want. I'm not sure if we have time for it. But
I think you've made the point. It's a really interesting point. It's kind of the repetition of life and how it leads you to some questionable decisions in some way, in many ways too.
Well, can I expand on that with the title? Hello, Young Lovers. It's a Rodgers and Hammerstein song. It's from The King and I.
Oh.
And in it, it's about the protagonist, Anna, is talking about her love, her previous, her past husband, who's now passed away, but she's sort of saying that the tradition continues with the new young lovers. So it's got this hillside setting where she was with her husband Tom, and now there are new lovers in the same on the same hill, looking at the same site. I can't quite remember the lyrics to it, but it's that same kind of repetition in Hello, Young Lovers, the Rodgers and Hammerstein song. So there are a few songwriting concepts within the Rodgers and Hammerstein version that are spread all over Hello, Young Lovers as an album.
Okay, so we could talk about exotic creatures, and I have my own theory about that. I think that really is a whole integrated, brilliant masterpiece. But let's jump ahead, in the interest of time, to FFS. Okay, so FFS happened, and that marked a change in how they approach things, while at the same time, the albums that followed were kind of still building in that Sparks 2.0 mode. But with FFS, they took on, they became a little bit more pop focused. They worked with a band again, and they kept those elements as they went through their career, right?
Yeah.
And so, do you see that as a continuation, or do you see that as a new version of Sparks?
Both, funnily enough. But to make sense of FFS, you have to reconsider the Seduction of Ingmar Bergman and how that ends, because.
Go on.
it's complicated. This is why it takes so much to write about.
Brilliant how you thought of this. Go.
So The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman is about somebody who, well, it's about Ingmar Bergman, who he's whisked off to Hollywood, and they're trying to persuade him to make a big budget Hollywood blockbuster instead of his arty film noir works. And it makes a compelling argument for going Hollywood or for sticking with, you know, the harder path and independent cinema. And ultimately, it ends with Ingmar rejecting Hollywood and being whisked back. Now, this came shortly before they first met Leos Carax. So if you think of it as being about Sparks deciding what sort of movie they make. So Annette, I know I'm going way off FFS here, but Annette is this dark film noir, it's a tragedy, and people have treated it like that's an inevitability. Of course Sparks would make a film like this, but all of Sparks' albums are like warm and funny. You know, it's very rare for them to do something truly dark. So also, they reference a lot of like film noir and, you know, the art world in their music, but Hollywood has got just as big a presence. You know, you've got Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse. You've got Gone with the Wind. It's Hollywood is easily as big a part. So in The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman, it basically ends with Ingmar completely rejecting Hollywood. And, you know, he said, "Oh my God, do you exist?" He's in turmoil. And I think that's because they realized, or they were stating, that in order to make the true movie that they wanted to make, they'd have to get rid of everything that's accessible about Sparks. And FFS, I think, is a reaction to that. FFS is saying that it starts with Johnny Delusional. I consider that any time you get a love interest in a Sparks song, it's their creative muse. So Johnny Delusional is, it's about being deluded, basically. And then, you know, the album ends with them saying collaborations don't work, and then they tell the band to piss off. So,
but it did change their template, right? You, continuity is there, especially with the albums that followed, where they reverted back to their insular approach to making the music. But at the same time, there was still a difference because they were now working in a more traditional 3-4 minute song structure and making stuff that was actually hitting the charts and things. While at the same time putting out stuff, leading with stuff like Hippopotamus, which just left everybody's head scratching, and as great as it was, but it wasn't a traditional pop song by any means, right?
Yeah, but what's interesting now, I think, is it's almost like the band split in two at that point, because during Hippopotamus, they were writing Annette. It took 9 years to produce Annette. So they were quite a... if you think that Little Beethoven, Exotic Creatures of the Deep, Hello Young Lovers, and The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman were almost half pop and half art. At that point, after The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman, they went far more accessible. So the music was... just closer, like just more straightforward. But at the same time that they were writing these like easier pop songs, they were writing this, you know, the difficult music and the dark music that you hear on Annette. So it's like they were working on two things in parallel. So, I was really surprised when I first heard Annette, just how
out there,
how different it is. How different it is to the Sparks we know. And it didn't utilize any of the... If it had made Annette and it was as poppy as Hippopotamus or a steady drip, 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 it would have been a completely different film. It would have been... I think people would have left the cinema being huge Sparks fans. And I think that's not what they wanted. They wanted a difficult art film. So they split the two sides of the band.
That's a really, really interesting point. And I know what my next question is, but I feel like, Christian, maybe I've been talking too much. So over to you.
I think I've been talking too much.
Oh, no, not at all. I just think I'm running out of time over here. But I would like to – you touched on it, and I would like to really ask you about you know, the film Annette a lot more, and you've touched on that more. But I'm good for now.
Well, then let me ask one more question. And that question is, we've gotten a taste of the new album so far. Taste, it's a pun, I guess, because of the latte. But we've gotten a taste of the new album so far. And where do you think they're going to go? What do you think we're going to get? Do you think we're going to get a continuation of the pop approach that we've been hearing, or do you think that this is the precursor to something that's going to be very different?
Oh, this is difficult because
it's all conjecture.
So I think going on the first song, the first the girl who's crying in a latte, follows the simplistic lyric style that you got on Annette. So lyrically, it hasn't got the same feel as a steady drip, drip, drip already.
No.
Musically, it sounds it's a bit more difficult. I can't imagine it being played on daytime radio, whereas a steady drip, 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 lots of it did.
Can I interject? Do you remember about maybe 3 years ago, there was a single that came out. There was a Sebastian, I think is the name.
Oh, I love Sebastian. Yeah.
Right.
Into a parking meeting.
That's the one. Right. Yeah. It reminded me so much of that song because it was very, very repetitive. The music, the lyrics, everything. It seemed to me to hearken a bit back to that, which is interesting because when I first heard that, I was like, oh, I like this. I just wish there were more going on musically and, and lyrically. And then this thing is here. And it reminded me so much of that. Anyway, go on. You were going to say something.
Yeah. So I think it the album starts more difficult than what we're used to. And I absolutely love the song, to be clear.
Yeah.
But I've been looking over the album titles to see if there are any, the song titles on the album, because there are certain themes that come up a lot in the lyrics. Something that comes up all the time is the idea of tans, being in the sun, being in the cold.
Sure.
And I see it like that, the hard work in the cold versus the glory of being out in the sunshine. This goes right back to Barbecue. Can I just deviate slightly? But
they do sing a lot about tans, don't they?
Yeah. So Barbecue, the opening line is,
yes,
for the good of man, he has forsaken his whole town.
For the good of man. Yeah.
Yeah, he has forsaken his whole town. Mm-hmm. Living in the snow, he is advancing what we know. Now think of the song Left Out in the Cold. Left Out in the Cold is about somebody doing hard research in the Arctic while other people feel the benefits. So the Barbecue is the same concept, separated by decades. For the good of man, he has forsaken his whole town. Living in the snow, he is advancing what we know. So it's something that while these might sound like throwaway ideas, just the fact that they hit the same concepts so many times and that clashes with where they are in their career a lot of the time. The album, one of the last songs is called It's Sunny Today, and I'm hoping that's going to be poppy and accessible because it's out.
I hope it's the opposite. I would love that.
Well, here's the thing is,
I'm with Christian on this. I hope I've noticed after two or three albums, they trying to change styles. And I'm hoping they just give us something. And it would be so Sparks to completely change styles now when they're at the height of their popularity. That would
this
be
is what
so
I'm saying.
Sparks. You've got to admit that, Paul.
This is exactly their band. I think the guy from Franz Ferdinand described them as having, he described them as having creative recklessness.
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfect way of describing the band. Yeah. And so many times when they're poised for great success or to build on what's come before, they'll do a complete left turn and do something just completely unexpected and almost like leave their audience behind. And the things that...
That's indiscreet in a nutshell.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. When I was talking about Terminal Jive earlier and Balls and Annette, in all three cases, they had a chance to build on previous success, but in my view, intentionally threw a spanner in the works. I think one of my central concepts about, well, how I see Annette is about having everything lined up to take over the world. You know, they had one of the most famous directors in the world. They had A-list talent. They had the budget. If they'd have left people with a warm feeling at the end of that movie, and, you know, a few catchy pop songs stuck in their head, it would have elevated them onto the next level.
Sure.
But I think that act of self-sabotage is built into what they do. And I know a lot of this sounds like I'm just pulling it out of the ether, but everything I've said has got lyrics to justify it. And I just wish I had the time to write it all. So, yeah.
Well, hopefully you will have time, and we will have time to have you back on here again to elucidate on those.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I mean, I hope I haven't come across too crazy with it all, because I know this is way outside what other people are saying.
We've had people much crazier. Much crazier.
Oh, what I would say is that we're just in complete admiration of how much you've thought about this and put it together and really developed a holistic theory. I may not agree with every single thing.
We're kind of Occam's razors kinds of guys.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But there's a lot that gave us both a lot to think about. And that's one of the reasons why we wanted to have you on here.
Yeah. According to you, everything we said about Terminal Jive was wrong. And
this is something I want to be really clear about. I did plan on saying this right at the start, but just because I've got these ideas about what these songs mean, it doesn't overwrite anything else, because these songs can be about a million. I've heard so many theories already on Facebook about what the girl is crying in a latte is about.
Sure.
There are so many ways of interpreting it, and it's valid. All I'm saying is that I think there's a starting point that comments on Sparks, and all of these other ways of interpreting it are still equally as valid.
I was just joking. I think it's brilliant the way you thought this through. And thanks so much for coming on.
We'll have you back on, man. Especially because I want to get back into Annette at some point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'd love to. I'd absolutely love to talk about that. All right. Yeah, great.
Thanks for being here. I'm so happy. This could be a great episode. And we'll be back again very soon, where we start getting into
angst.
Angst. Angst in your pants. Thank you.